listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is more or less Anything Goes Friday in our second hour today. Matt Taibbi is going to drop by at the top of the hour, and the United States Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez, is going to drop by at the bottom of the hour. It should be interesting. The new jobs figures are out. Looks good. 5.8% unemployment. More consequentially, the labor participation rate is starting to go up, which is, you know, it all looks good for the economy. You know, notwithstanding my perennial warnings and concerns about how this economy moves forward. But, you know, at a certain point, pent-up demand reaches the point where it's like, and actually I would say that probably the main thing that's going on and that will happen over the next who knows how many months is that the Saudis decided enough already of this American frackers getting in on the cheap oil business or on the expensive, you know, $100 barrel oil. Fracking is a very expensive process. This was the point that Dick Cheney made back when he made that famous statement, you know, Iraq's got 10% of the world's oil, very significant oil reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia. Dick Cheney said that back in 2001. And he was right. And you have to understand these different kinds of oil. So you've got, in Iraq, it was what's called virgin oil. And in other words, the oil wells had never been drilled into. They'd only been discovered by, you know, seismic measurement and whatnot. And when you drill into wells like this, you get the Jed Clampett effect. You get gushers. The oil is under pressure. It comes up out of the ground through the oil wells without any effort. And so that oil costs you maybe $5 or $10 a barrel to produce. So when you sell that oil for $100 a barrel, it's mind-bogglingly profitable. Now, Saudi oil, their wells are a little less than half drained. So they're having to suck on the straw, right? Which means that they've got to suck on the straw with giant electric pumps or diesel fuel-driven pumps that are pumping this stuff out. So Saudi oil costs $15, $20, $25, $30, in some cases as much as $40 or $50 a barrel to extract. But at $100 a barrel, they can make money. Even at $70 a barrel, they can make money. And then you look at fracking. Fracking can cost $80 a barrel. Fracking is very expensive. But when oil is $100 a barrel, hey, $20 a barrel, we'll pull out a million barrels, we'll make some money. So the Saudis looked at this and they said, you know, the world is awash in oil right now because the United States, they're fracking like crazy. The United States is now the second largest oil exporter on the planet. Fixing to be number one, and we're not importing the kind of Saudi oil we used to. So they said, screw that. We're going to dump all this oil onto the markets and drive the price down. And they drove the price down to like $70. Their goal is to put American frackers out of business, or at least cause them to at least slow down the momentum, which they've accomplished. Fracking operations around the United States right now are kind of teetering. Now, there are some that are discovering, you know, roughly the equivalent of virgin crude. We're fracking it out like the Bakken oil shale field in North Dakota. We're fracking it out. It's still only costing $20, $30 a barrel, and they can pump lots and lots of that. So anyhow, that's going on, and what that's doing, in addition to, you know, I mean, the Saudis are doing this. They don't care about the U.S. domestic economy. They care about competition, right? But by doing this, by driving the price of oil down to $70 a barrel, they're driving the price of gasoline down below $3 a gallon, which means that for working people in the United States who are the real job creators, the bottom half of the job market, people making less than $25,000 a year, they are the job creators because they spend the money that creates what's called aggregate demand. They spend the money that creates demand in the economy, and that's 70% of our economy is, you know, consumers buying things, and now they've got an extra $30 a month, $50 a month, $100 a month, depending on how much they spend on gasoline. And so the Saudis driving down the price of oil stimulates the economy. And you can look at this all the way back to the 60s. Look at every, you know, when Jimmy Carter inherited this inflation, it was the consequence of the economy being whacked. What whacked the economy? The Arab oil embargo. When the price of oil goes up, the economy goes in the tank. When the price of oil goes down, the economy booms. Why? Because gasoline is cheaper and average consumers have a little extra money in their pocket, and they'll take that money to the store and buy something that they wouldn't have otherwise bought. Because at the bottom half of the labor market, by and large, people don't take extra money and save it. Unlike the Koch brothers or, you know, anybody who's making over a couple $100,000 a year and not living beyond their means, if they make extra money, they save it, which doesn't help the economy at all. So, number one, that's happening with the economy. And that's why, in my opinion. Number two, we'll see, you know, just a bunch of things here I wanted to share with you. We'll see where this election goes. The senator-elect from Oklahoma, the old senator from Oklahoma, the existing senator, who was not up for re-election, James Inhofe, he's going to become, he's the guy who wrote the book on the hoax of climate change and how these climate scientists are just, you know, they made this thing up so that they could get more government grants because they're so greedy. The oil executives are not greedy. Right? The oil industry would never lie to us. They certainly would never lie to Jim Inhofe. They would never allow him to make a fool of himself by writing a book based on lies. Right? Well, this is what Jim Inhofe apparently believes. And in fact, in his book, he talks about how, you know, God said in Genesis, you know, I'm creating this world. It's for you. As long as it's around, you're around. And he says, God's still on his throne. You know, things are going to be fine. Don't worry. Be happy. Pump that oil. Let the Koch brothers make more money. Right. So the new Oklahoma senator is a guy named James Lankford, another Republican, and he's going to defeat the national debt using a biblical worldview. Isn't that great? There's a great little roundup piece over at Huffington Post today by Nicholas Wing, about the whack jobs who just got elected to Congress. Republican Jody Heiss of Georgia, for example. He says Islam is not a real religion, and therefore Muslims in the United States don't deserve First Amendment protections. Right?
Right.
He says abortion is worse than Hitler's 6 million Jews or Mussolini's 300,000. He says the gay community is trying to seduce and sodomize your children. He supports nullification. He wants to relitigate the Civil War. He says women should ask their husbands for permission to enter politics. This guy just got elected. That's one guy. The next is Ryan Zink, a former Navy SEAL of Montana, handily won a seat. He has referred to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as the Antichrist.
Right.
He led an anti-Obama super PAC. He said the president, quote, conveniently took credit for killing Osama bin Laden for political gain.
Right.
Glenn Grothman, Wisconsin Republican. He says, what do we need weekends for? It's a little ridiculous that Wisconsin had laws against a 7-day work week. And he says women get paid less because money's more important for men. He says teachers should be banned from discussing homosexuality because it could turn kids gay. The people on food stamps eat too well, and Planned Parenthood is the most overtly racist organization in America. Michael Perutka was just elected as a Republican in Maryland. Amazing. He calls the LGBT death style and says they want to recruit your children. I mean, it just goes on and on. There's this long list of these crazies. We'll continue with this right after this. Stick around, and then we'll pick up your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, yeah, it's anything goes for. I wanted to get a few things out here. Anyway, Bernie was with us on Wednesday, you'll recall, so no Bernie today. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here. And John in Springfield, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, John, you had a question?
Yes, Tom, I listen to every morning. There's a station, local station, that has an investment group here in Dayton, Ohio, who has this segment on investments. Mm-hmm. And they talk to the host of the show, And they were saying yesterday that the reason why these companies monopolize is because of all the regulation they have to deal with. Now, what do you think of that statement?
Well, it's the other way around. The large monopolies typically create the regulation. I realize that, you know, the whole Republican talking point right now is regulation is killing business. But if you look at the regulations on the GMO industry, for example, I wrote about this in my book on equal protection. They were requested by Monsanto. When Monsanto developed the first GMOs, George Herbert Walker Bush was president. There were no rules regarding GMOs. So Monsanto walks into the vice president's office at the time. It was just before it was when Reagan was still president. They walk into the vice president's office and they say, we need regulation basically to keep out smaller competitors. You know, make it very complex, make it very difficult because we're a giant company. And you find that an awful lot of regulations are supported by industry. The reason why when Republicans talk about how much they hate regulation, they never name any specifics is because what they're really saying is the regulations that help industry, we're all in favor, these giant monopolies, we're all in favor of. The regulations that cost them money, which would be basically EPA stuff. I mean, that's principally it. You know, we're opposed to. And so they're willing to trade the future and health of your children and you and everybody else, you know, the air and water and whatnot, in exchange for corporate profits. It's nonsense, John, what these guys are saying.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Jack, watching Free Speech TV in Lakeport, California. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
I watch you pretty nearly every morning on Free Speech TV, but
thank you.
I have a question about a thing called Internet democracy, where the people can follow the legislation that's being written as it's being written, be able to communicate in mass in a voting type straw poll vote to let their politicians know directly. I disagree with that, and this is where I disagree with it, or I agree with it. And the politician doesn't have to follow the people's vote on this straw poll website,
right.
But if they don't, they better be able to explain how, because we'll take great care in keeping track of every one of them. But if they go against the people too many times, we've got a way of holding them accountable, because to me that is the one big problem.
I don't believe it, Jack. I don't believe it. These kind of websites are the kind of websites that the well-funded right-wing groups put up, and then they basically flood the website with their own opinion and then say, see, look at this.
Okay, to control the vote.
Sure. I mean, you know, if they create 10,000 robots and just plug votes in, or they could spam people and say, go over to the website and vote. You know, it is an attempt to manipulate Congress, and, you know, a fairly weak and transparent one at that. The fact of the matter is that, you know, fewer than 1% of Americans are that engaged in politics that they're going to want to watch legislation as it's being cooked. But the lobbyists, the special interest groups, the big corporations who will be influenced by that legislation, I bet anything they're the ones who are behind websites like this. They would pay for that kind of thing. Thanks a lot for the call, Jack. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple of other things I wanted to drop in here. Just interesting news I saw flying by that I think is worth commenting on. Here's two stories from two very different points of view that highlight what I think might be, frankly, a problem. The Supreme Court has said that police agencies can't slap a GPS device on your car without a warrant. But that doesn't mean a bank can't. So what's happening is that car dealerships are hooking up with banksters who do subprime. This subprime means, you know, loans for people with a credit score below, I believe, 660, who do subprime loans for cars. Now, they want to be able to take these car loans and turn them into derivatives, right? So they've got to have some way to have some guarantee that they'll be paid back. So what they're doing is they're putting GPS-enabled devices in these cars between the ignition system, right, in the electrical system. So that if you buy a car and you take one of these loans and you are 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 days late on the loan payment, they just disable your car. And the New York Times says that over 2 million cars are now outfitted with such kill switches. It's about a quarter of the subprime car loans. And it's you know, it's increasing. And then they note some borrowers say their cars were disabled when they were only a few days behind on their payments, leaving them stranded in dangerous neighborhoods. Others said their cars were shut down while idling at stoplights. Some described how they could not take their children to school or doctor's appointments. One woman in Nevada said that her car was shut down while she was driving on the freeway. Not good stuff. Right? The devices also have the ability to allow lenders and others to know the movements of borrowers, which is a major concern for privacy advocates. And these devices emit beeps. When you start going late on your payment, it starts beeping at you, and the beeps get louder and more rapid as time goes on, as your payments are later and later. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, which reminds me, I mean, this is like treating people like children, sort of like the way John Boehner said to President Obama, you know, look out, you play with matches, you'll get your fingers burned. This is how parents talk to their children. I mean, how disrespectful is that? But anyway, this back to this story. Now we find that this woman, Carlicia Freeland Gaither, was abducted. She was a medical technician, I believe, and she was abducted in Philadelphia, a nursing assistant, excuse me, abducted in Philadelphia. It was caught on surveillance video. And on the surveillance video, they saw that this guy's car had a sticker for one of these car dealers who do these subprime loans. So the police contacted the dealer, said, do you have a GPS device in this guy's car? The dealer said, we sure do. The police said, would you mind telling us where the car is? They said, no problem. Here's where he is. Police went to where his car was. There he was. There was the woman he abducted. They rescued the woman. Happy ending, right? Or is it? I mean, it almost makes it seem like these are a good thing. And I guess if you get abducted by somebody who's got one of these subprime car loans, it's a good thing. But it just seems to me like, you know, Big Brother has just gone over the edge. Okay, another story here. This is the news of the day that I find fascinating. I wanted to share with you, and then we'll pick up your calls. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, this from the Washington Post, I believe, today, Kimberly Kindy writing, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration does not perform enough pesticide residue tests on either imported or domestic foods to say whether the American food supply is safe. According to federal auditors, this is the Federal Government Accountability Office. They released a report saying the FDA is testing fewer than one-tenth, less than one-tenth of 1% of all imported fruits and vegetables and less than 1% of domestic ones, meaning that their pesticide testing program is not statistically valid. It's impossible to meet the mandate, which is, quote, to determine the national incident and level of pesticide residues in the food it regulates. Now, why would this be? Well, it might have something to do with the way that Republicans have cut the FDA's budget year after year after year after year, decade after decade. That's an interesting one. Here's another one. This from the New York Times. More than 600 American soldiers. The Pentagon is now acknowledging more than 600 American soldiers were exposed to poison gas in Iraq. Yes, there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. No, Saddam Hussein did not even know he had them. No, they were not usable against us. George Bush did lie to us. We got over there, and what we discovered was that Saddam Hussein had tried to destroy or buried all the old chemical weapons that Don Rumsfeld had sold him back during the Reagan administration during the war with Iran. These things were 20 years old. They were leaking. They were in bad shape. Saddam Hussein buried them. Our soldiers dug them up because they were desperately looking for weapons of mass destruction. And when they realized that these were 20-year-old weapons, this isn't what Bush was talking about. When the soldiers dug them up, they got exposed. You know, they bust these things open or they were leaking. 600 American soldiers were exposed to poison gas. Many of them are badly disabled now as a consequence of it. And the Bush administration ordered the Pentagon to hide that. Now, we can't let people know that. That would reflect badly on George and Donnie and Condi and Dickie, right? It's amazing. Sarin or sulfur mustard gas. And finally, a great piece over at Vanity Fair right now, 30 Years of Conservative Nonsense by Kurt Eichenwald, the New York Times reporter. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So I've got a little bit of the news for the day out of my system. I will share more with you as we go on through the program, but after this break, I'll be picking up your phone calls. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, Tom, it's always good to call the show, and I'd like to thank you for giving the general public a an area to voice their opinions and also concerns.
Thank you.
But one of the things I've seen recently, and this was actually before the election, there were images from China about a marathon they ran. I don't know if you had seen this.
No.
But the pollution was so bad that even the great distance runners from Africa had to quit halfway through.
Whoa.
Now, it was really scary to see this. And when I seen those images, I said, this is the Republican agenda.
Yeah.
Cutting the EPA's legs out from underneath them.
Yep.
And if you could possibly pass this information to Senator Sanders, I think it would be a good bullet in his arsenal to show these images to the American public and also to his fellow constituents.
Also how it is that China's able to produce goods so cheaply. Not only do they have very cheap labor, although the cost of labor is increasing as the Chinese middle class gets larger and workers are demanding more, but they do, you know, their manufacturers don't pay for pollution controls, and so their landscape in much of China is just an absolute toxic wasteland. And this is the big issue. I was talking with Peggy Liu, who's Chinese and fairly well wired in with the Chinese government, on TV about a month ago. We did a half hour discussion with her, and she said, you know, this is the big issue one of the biggest issues that average Chinese are really upset about, and that the Chinese government is taking very, very seriously, is what do we do about all this pollution, most of it caused by coal-fired power plants. And it's one of the reasons why China is leading the world in new installations of wind and solar power. But they're still also leading the world in building new coal-fired power plants and importing coal from the United States. So, great point, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share a story that I thought just probably isn't getting enough attention, at least in the national media, to the robocalls that went out to the 2,000 election judges in Illinois.
It wasn't across Illinois. It was just in Chicago. It was only in Democratic, heavily Democratic districts.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently 2,000 judges failed to show up, and there were debacles getting the polls.
That's right. So the polls couldn't open for hours, and as a consequence of that, a lot of people did not vote or were turned away. And as a consequence of that, Pat Quinn is no longer the governor of Illinois, in my opinion.
I completely agree. And they were even saying that that the calls suggested that a person needed to vote the entire Republican ticket to be eligible as a judge at all. And also the robocalls, and I'm reading this right from a local news source, that they had to report polling place problems directly to the Republican Party, and they were required to get additional training before ever reporting for duty. So most of the people were like, well,
As far as I know, the only part of that that's factual or accurate, at least as it's being reported broadly, is that these election judges got these robocalls that said, you have not completed your training to be an election judge, so unless you complete this training by Tuesday morning, please don't show up. And these were calls on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And so, like you say, 2,000 judges didn't show up. And, Ben, if you don't have an election judge, you can't open the polls. And it took hours in many cases for these polls to open. And this was a big – and this was an attempt at election fraud. This is Republican election fraud, which is different from voter fraud, which is what they're all hysterical and talking about. There is no voter fraud, but there's serious and consequential election fraud in the United States, and this is one example of it. Marty, thanks a lot for pointing that out. We talked with Brad Friedman about this yesterday. Hazel in Deming, New Mexico. Hey, Hazel, what's up?
Hi. I can't understand why Congress and these four, Justice Superior, they want to skip Obama of his powers of trying to help the public, the system. I don't understand that.
Well, you have to understand, the Republican Party, by and large, is a wholly owned subsidiary of billionaires and big corporations, Inc., right? I mean, there's this coalition of the Chamber of Commerce, the big corporations, and the Koch brothers and the other billionaires, and they own the Republican Party. And so the Republican Party, and by the way, they have, I mean, this is Harry Truman ran on this in 1946. They have owned the Republican Party, you know, arguably since the 1880s. And certainly since the 1890s. And so the Republican Party does not want the president to do anything that might not be in the best interests of billionaires or transnational corporations. They certainly don't want him to do anything that might help average people. And so that's why they want to take away his executive powers. And then they're also, you know, they get this power by catering to all these different slices of the electorate. They get the anti-abortion slice. They get the fundamentalist Christian slice. They get the white guys who like to have their guns slice. And then there's a very large slice in the South, which is white people who are afraid of or even hate black people, the racist slice. And so by going after Obama and calling him a dictator when he does the exact same things that Ronald Reagan and George Bush did in terms of legitimately and constitutionally exercising executive powers, they cause all the, you know, the white racists to go, oh, he's a dictator. He's acting like, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So that's what's going on, Hazel. And it's going to continue to go on, frankly, as long as there's a Republican Party. And the horrifying thing is that our news media pretends as if the Republicans have some kind of legitimate position, like there's a legitimate debate here. There isn't. Hazel, thank you for the call. Spencer in Skowhegan, Maine. Am I there? Skowhegan, Maine? Am I saying that right?
Yes, Skowhegan.
Okay. You're on the air.
Well, I'm independently wealthy, Tom. I also suffer from schizoaffective disorder, which is kind of a mix between bipolar and schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very passionate about mental health rights.
Good.
So long story short, I own an 18,000 square foot property not far away, just out of town, and I'm looking to invest about $3 million into revamping that and turning it into a nonprofit home, like a halfway house for the mentally ill. My goal is to get them on disability and food stamps and stuff like that.
Good on you.
Yeah, thanks.
So is your point that not all wealthy people are bad people like the Koch brothers?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, the Koch brothers are worth 100 times, probably 1 million times more than what I'm worth.
Yeah.
But I don't think all rich people are bad, and you know...
No, all rich people are not bad. I know a couple of billionaires who are really good and decent people. I mean, it's just a couple of millionaires, too. Multimillionaires, very, very wealthy people. And, you know, you're right. But they tend not to be as involved in politics as the billionaires who are just looking out. You know, who I think have obsessive compulsive disorder and hoarding syndrome, and they're directing their OCD at money, and there's just never enough. They've always got to have more, and it doesn't matter who gets hurt to get it. And that's not true of all rich people, certainly, but I believe it's true of these rich Republican activists. Who are just,
yes,
you know.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. All they want is another tax break. Spencer, thank you for the call. I wish you well in your endeavors. It's a noble work you're talking about doing. Jamie in Chicago. Hey, Jamie, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi, Jamie. What's up?
Hi. I just want to make a couple of comments. With the newly elected Republican Congress not letting know that the inmates are going to be running the asylum. And I hope that President Obama has enough fortitude to stand up to them.
Me too.
My comment was going to be about illegal immigration. All these Republicans keep saying that that we got to tighten up the laws and all this. The only laws that these people is breaking is coming to this country to provide for their families.
Right.
The other thing is that they keep saying tighten up the laws, but there's laws in the books that employers are supposed to go to jail for hiring these illegal immigrants without proper documentation. but none of them go to jail.
Right.
They just keep abusing these immigrants left and right, get rid of them whenever they want. So that's my comment.
Yeah, well, you're right, Jamie. And you know, how this happened was, you know, prior to 1986, if employers hired people who were not here with documentation, they faced the same kind of sanctions they face in pretty much every other country in the world. They could go to jail. They could have large fines. They could lose their business. You know, there were severe consequences to that. Those consequences are still on the books. But Ronald Reagan in 1986, after his immigration reform and amnesty for about 5 or 6 million people, stopped enforcing the laws against, by and large, wealthy white guys hiring people who are here without documentation. And the result is that, you know, 10 to 15 million people have come here looking for work, which is an entirely reasonable, rational, and appropriate thing for them to be doing. You know, hey, there's no penalty, and the employers are more than glad to hire them. And you see this writ large in the construction industry and the meatpacking industry. Both of these used to be very high-wage, entirely unionized industries, and now they're mostly filled with people who are not U.S. citizens. So you're right. This would be the solution to the problem, as it were. But first, we've got to do something about the people that basically Ronald Reagan said, "Hey, come on in," and you know, and those policies. Jamie, thanks for the call. These are not bad people. These are not bad people. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer
You're
problem.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. It's Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Matt Taibbi at the top of the hour. No, he'll be at... Yeah. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Where'd my one sheet go? Ah, here it is. Okay. Let's see here. Luther, watching Free Speech TV in Grenada, Mississippi. Hey, Luther, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up? Luther? Luther is listening to his television instead of his telephone. Bruce in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Bruce, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Dr. Hartman. Good afternoon. Well, a quick question is about that caucus room conspiracy you mentioned quite often.
Yeah.
I'd like to know... why is it that any women Republicans were conspicuously absent at this little get-together? Why do you think that is? There are women in the Congress, Republican women, are there not?
There are, but there aren't any who actually hold any consequential power.
Ah.
This was a meeting. I mean, let me just go through the list real quick here. You had Paul Ryan. He's the head of the Budget Committee. He's arguably one of the three or four most powerful Republicans in the House. You had Eric Cantor, who was the number two Republican. You had Kevin McCarthy, who is now the Republican whip, the second most powerful Republican in the House. You had Pete Sessions, who's one of the most long-serving members from Texas and one of the most powerful. He's the head of I forget which committee, but it's a big deal. You had Jeb Hensarling, same thing. Pete Hoekstra, the Republican from Michigan, who's a major member of the Republican leadership. Dan Lundgren, the Republican from California, who's on, I believe, the Armed Services Committee. So, I mean, these guys control an enormous amount of money and a lot of appropriations. And then from the Senate, you had Jim DeMint, who now runs the Heritage Foundation. He was one of the leading intellectual leaders and power brokers in the Republican Party. You have John Kyle, the Republican from Arizona, who's the rational rational twin to John McCain in Arizona. You had Tom Coburn, Dr. No, the guy who was responsible for at least half of all the filibusters during the Obama presidency. You have John Ensign, from the Republican from Nevada, who is Harry Reid's, you know, sworn enemy. And you had Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee, another very powerful Republican. So these were the people who were there. They were the people of considerable power. I mean, the closest that you've got with regard to women is, what's her name, who did the Republican address 2 years ago? Kathy McMorris Rogers, I think is her name, something like that. And you know, she's arguably has some power in Congress, but not of any great consequence. This was literally the old boys club. And in the Republican Party, the old boys run the old boys club.
Ah, so that's right. Because that came to mind quickly at one point earlier when you were mentioning all these names. So that's strange. There are no women involved in this conspiracy at all. I found that odd.
Yeah.
But I guess it's not so odd.
No, I don't think so. I, you know, and And, you know, it's, I mean, there's several Republicans who just got elected who are on the record saying women, you know, this one guy who says a woman should not go into politics unless she has her husband's permission. You know, this is this kind of bizarre patriarchal worldview that's carried by many Christian evangelicals who, you know, comprise a significant portion of the Republican base. So, of course, they're not going to have women in positions of power. That would offend their base. It would offend their ideals. It would offend their notion of things. They read Paul in Romans where he said, you know, when a woman goes to church, she should cover her head. She should sit in the back. She should remain silent. She should defer to her husband in all things, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They're very Pauline in that. Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point, though. You caught something there that's worth catching. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul Aaron's on the line with us. He is a student, a senior at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay and co-chair of the Green Bay Move to Amend organization. He's a student of Professor Harvey Kay, who was on the show a couple days ago. Professor Harvey Kay, the author of several of my favorite books. And Paul, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. I understand you got a constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United, say corporations aren't people and money is not speech, on the ballot in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
What I was actually involved in was just getting the resolution on the ballot for Green Bay.
Yep. Okay.
And there were several other municipalities in Wisconsin that also did the same.
So, and how did that turn out?
It was really good, actually. 77%, I believe, was the exact number for how many people voted.
I'm sorry, say that again?
77%.
77%?
Yeah, 77% voted in favor of it.
Were there any politicians in Wisconsin who got 77% of the vote?
No way. Nothing near that I saw, anyway.
So getting money out of politics, saying corporations are not human beings, are not persons, and not protected by the 14th Amendment, and money is not speech and thus not protected by the First Amendment, is more popular than any politician in Wisconsin?
Yes.
Wow. Exactly. That's amazing.
Yeah, that blew my mind too.
Yeah. That is incredible.
It was optimistic because, you know, regardless of what people's feelings were about the outcome of the election, 77% of people agree on something really important. So.
Yeah. How did you get involved with Move to Amend, Paul?
Well, the organization was founded by a retired teacher. Her name's Betty Kosick.
Uh-huh.
She also lives in Green Bay. She founded it after running into some people in a national organization, and, you know, they just said, well, if you want to start up a local, not technically a chapter, but if you want to start up a local organization, you're free to do so. And she did that, and I actually ran into Betty at UWGB when she was collecting petition signatures to get the referendum put on the ballot. And, you know, she mentioned that she was having a hard time getting into the college. She was getting kicked out by security, and people were even still giving her a hard time in the parking lot, and, you know, I said, well, you know, let me help you if I can. I'm a student here, and I'm sure I could get you some tables so you can collect signatures. And I'm thinking, it's not right that you're getting kicked out and all this, and you're getting such a hard time. So, you know, one thing led to another, and I helped her through that, and she just offered she said she needed a co-chair at one point, and I offered to help her. And, yeah, we got enough petition signatures. We had a couple hundred over. We sent it to City Hall, and, you know, one night we went there and we just kind of, you know, proposed the resolution to them, spoke for a few minutes, and yeah, actually all of the aldermen in Green Bay, or at least most of them, were already in favor of the resolution, but they felt, and we agreed that by putting it to a ballot, it would have more sway since it wasn't a binding resolution.
That is absolutely great. Paul, congratulations on your activism. Congratulations on your electoral success on Tuesday. We keep hearing, you know, over and over and over again all over the country. And Wisconsin, of course, just reelected Scott Walker. And on that exact same ballot, 77% of Wisconsinites voted to say money is not speech and corporations are not people. Congratulations on that, Paul.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Great. And thanks for dropping by today. And please say hi to Harvey for me. Paul Aaron's, a senior at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay and our democracy hero for the day. Ed in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ed.
wondering about this corporations revoking their charter.
Yeah.
They were talking about that with that Chevron spill off of Santa Barbara or something.
Yeah.
And I wondered what would be the process for doing that. You would go to the state to which they were incorporated in?
Yes.
And what's the process?
There's two pieces to it. This is a process that's done by the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State is responsible for maintaining corporate charters. It's where when you incorporate, you submit your forms to the Secretary of State's office. They have oversight over corporations incorporated in their states. They also have oversight over businesses that are what are called foreign corporations. In other words, a corporation that was chartered in another state that is doing business in their state. So, you know, when you start a corporation, say you registered as a Delaware corporation, but you're going to do business in California, then you have to also register as a foreign corporation with the California Secretary of State's office. So let's say that Chevron was a Delaware corporation. I don't know if it is or not, but the odds are fairly high that it is. You know, virtually all the Fortune 500 companies are Delaware corporations because their corporate laws are very, very loose. So if it's a Delaware corporation, but it's doing business in California, the California Secretary of State can revoke their license to do business or their right to do business in the state of California. They can't give them the corporate death penalty, but they can order them out of the state. The state of Delaware is the one that has the right to pull their entire charter. And again, that would be the Secretary of State of Delaware. It can also be done by legislative action. Legislatures can direct the secretaries of state to pull the charters of corporations in most states. It depends on state law, but in most states, legislatures can do that. But it basically has never happened in the 20 or 21st century. This used to happen from time to time in the 19th century, late 19th century. But it all came to largely a screeching halt in the 1890s. When Ohio told John Rockefeller that they were going to put him in jail if he didn't stop his monopolistic behavior, and they were going to shut down his corporation, Standard Oil of Ohio, because he was violating the trust laws, the Sherman Antitrust Act, and its state analog in Ohio. And so John Rockefeller basically said to all the states, he said, "Who wants my business? I got millions of dollars. I'll bring a lot of activity to your state. What state would like Standard Oil?" And it kicked off and all you have to do is change your charter laws, because the charter laws used to say that when you incorporate in a state, your first statement of purpose has to be to benefit the people of that state. And clearly John Rockefeller was not doing that in Ohio. And so what is referred to as the charter mongering era was kicked off by this. It lasted 6 or 8 years and mostly hit the Northeast. Immediately, New Jersey said, we'll water down our corporate charter laws. Then New York said, we'll do it. Then Connecticut said, we'll do it. Then Delaware said, I got you all beat. You know, we'll make it really, really simple. You can incorporate with a single line statement. You can have just one incorporator, virtually no responsibility. And, but John Rockefeller went with New Jersey. But most other corporations since then have gone with Delaware. So what we really need to do is we need to be changing the corporate charter laws state by state around the country. But that's not going to happen until the move to amend thing is passed, where corporations are no longer persons. Otherwise, they'll be able to fight it. Ed, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent and Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by Free Speech TV. Welcome back to the program. Matt Taibbi on the line with us, one of the finest investigative reporters working in this country. Contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. He's got a new piece in RollingStone.com. The $9 billion witness. Meet J.P. Morgan Chase's worst nightmare. Hey, Matt, great to have you back with us.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just super. And thank you for the great work you're doing, and it's great to have you back at Rolling Stone. Tell me about Elaine Fleishman.
Yeah, so Elaine Fleishman was the central cooperating witness that the government had last year in the settlement they struck with J.P. Morgan Chase, which at the time was the biggest settlement in the history of the country. It was a $13 billion deal. There were leaks to the press right around a year ago this month that the government had an insider who was talking to investigators, mm-hmm. and that news, I think, helped create some of the leverage that the state used to extract more money out of the bank. But the identity of that person was a secret until this week, and she's come forward and is talking in this article really about her frustrations not only with the bank but with the justice system and the settlements that went through, which she felt were inadequate.
Yeah, so if I could rephrase and you tell me if I've got this right.
Sure.
Elaine Fleishman was working inside J.P. Morgan Chase. She saw them committing crimes, real crimes, fraud,
mm-hmm.
and frauds that destroyed the lives of millions of Americans. She went to the Justice Department and said, I will be your whistleblower inside, or your leaker, or whatever the phrase is, your cooperating witness, you use that phrase. They said, great, we will use your testimony to go after J.P. Morgan. They went after them. They got $13 billion. And according to the corporate media, case closed. Everyone goes home happy. Of course, all those people's lives are still ruined. And the banksters, Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, he just, you know, writes a check for $13 billion or $9 billion, whatever it is, to the federal government and says that's it. And she's left going, hey, what happened? You know, there's an actual crime here. Nobody got prosecuted for it. And the $13 billion or $9 billion is a slap on the wrist. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And I think from her perspective, she believed, actually, until pretty recently, that the government still intended at some point to pursue earnest prosecutions against not only J.P. Morgan Chase and the people that she worked with, but against people who did similar things at other companies like Bank of America and Citigroup. And what prompted her to come forward was she saw that the Justice Department had concluded a series of extremely similar deals that all involved the same characteristics. No individual penalties, no fines for individual people, no charges against individuals. The shareholders bore the entire brunt of the settlements. Some of the penalties were tax deductible. None of them were brought before judges. And the biggest thing was that it hid the details of the crimes, and that was what she was most frustrated with. And she really came forward so that people could actually know what happened.
Now, typically when somebody is a witness for the government in one of these backroom deals, basically, you know, this was not negotiated out in open, this was not litigated in an open court. So typically when somebody is a participating or a witness, they are under some sort of compulsion for confidentiality. Is she not?
No, not with the government. No.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, she's a private individual who works at this company, and she's, the issue that she has is that when she went to work for J.P. Morgan Chase way back in 2006, she signed a confidentiality agreement, a standard kind of agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are differing opinions about whether or not she's violating that now by talking. Some people say that you cannot. That the confidentiality agreement can't prevent you from reporting a crime, but whatever it is, that's the issue with her. You know, she has to consider that as she's talking to
them. Yeah, there is a core doctrine of law in the United States that you cannot abrogate, you cannot contractually bind people to criminal behavior.
That's right.
Or to behavior that covers up criminal behavior. So, you know, once it slides into the realm of criminal behavior, all bets are off. So what is it that she would like to see happen?
Well, one of the reasons that she came forward when she did is that the statutes of limitations are running out for the last types of criminal cases they could possibly charge individuals with.
So the banksters are just about to get off scot-free totally.
Exactly. And one of the things that's a key detail in this whole thing is that the government did not start investigating any of this stuff until 2012. And that was almost exactly 6 years after a lot of these crimes took place, which happens to be the statute of limitations for many varieties of fraud. So they didn't start looking into it until the statutes of limitations had already expired in a lot of these cases. So there's a 10-year limit for wire fraud. They could still charge that, and she wants to put some pressure on the government and on people to pressure the government before those elapse.
So is her call to action to people like you and me and our listeners and viewers to contact the AG's office or the Obama administration?
Perhaps more to the point, and I know this sounds boring, but their congressman or their senator.
And ask for hearings?
Yeah, and ask for hearings and demand to know why these cases are not being brought. I mean, one of the key things that she talks about is, and there's this myth that's been spread over the years by people like Holder and the former head of the criminal division, Lanny Brewer, is that, you know, these cases are just so hard, they're so difficult, if we brought them, we wouldn't win, juries don't understand it. Now we always suspected that was not true, and now we have somebody who was inside all of this, who in addition is also a lawyer, and who is telling us openly, these cases are not hard, and in her case, it would be very easy to bring criminal charges. She believes it's a slam dunk, with the evidence that she has. So that excuse is not going to hold water anymore.
She also says in your article that coming forward like this could be the end of her, that she could lose her law license, that she could be ruined, that she might never again be hired by anybody. That's pretty grim stuff. She's really putting herself on the line here.
Well, unfortunately, that's kind of the situation with most whistleblowers. You have to take an enormous risk to come forward, and there's always the kind of non-specific risk that just talking about your company is going to dissuade anybody else from ever hiring you. I mean, I had a whistleblower in another case who couldn't even get a job as a waitress, and she worked in the financial services industry. There's a whistleblower for Countrywide who I interviewed who recently had essentially kind of a wrongful termination suit against the company overturned, and as a result they put a lien on his house, so he ended up paying $98,000 fine to Countrywide/Bank of America. These people always suffer financially. It's not an uncommon thing, and these companies don't have a sense of humor about this kind of thing. It's very common for them to go after these people with everything they've got.
Amazing. You can read all about it over at rollingstone.com, or even better, pick up a copy of Rolling Stone or subscribe to Rolling Stone. It's one of the great magazines out there, or newspapers, and it has one of the finest investigative reporters in the country working for it, Matt Taibbi, our guest. The current article, The $9 Billion Witness. Matt, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Always great talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday. Your calls, my thoughts on the news of the day. A few more details of the news coming up after this. And welcome back. Dale watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Harmony, North Carolina. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Tom, I want to talk to you about the wet milling industry, making ethanol and everything there where they use sulfuric acid break the starches down in the corn, and that sulfuric acid is in the byproducts, and it's going into animal feeds. And you got mycotoxin problems. And then the government has got those rates set so high that it's actually making the cows toxic to the point they're suffering sulfur toxicity. They're dying from it. The mycotoxins is playing a role in there. They're also, you got a carbohydrate overload because the starches have been depleted out of that.
Right.
And then the sulfur is...
That causes the cows to just get fat, though. That's what they want, isn't it? The carbohydrate overload?
No. It burns them up from the inside out, destroys the internal organs, kidneys, and everything.
Yikes.
And,
now, mycotoxins, that means toxins from mushrooms. Where's that coming from? Is that just from grain sitting around too long?
That's coming from the molds off of the grain.
Right.
Sulfuric acid magnifies that for several times when they run that wet milling process. But the sulfuric acid destroys the vitamins and minerals.
So why are the farmers not raising hell about this? Or is that what you're doing?
They are, but they don't know what's going on, and the veterinarians are scared to talk about it. There are cows dying here in North Carolina. I just went to Tennessee, and they're dying in Tennessee with the same thing. Everybody's scared to talk about it.
And it's all because they're being fed the corn debris after corn has had ethanol extracted from it or has been converted into ethanol.
All kinds of wet milling processes there through all your cereal grains and stuff there. And I presume that even humans are getting traces of sulfuric acid and stuff that they're getting because it's widely used, is what I understand, in all the wet milling stuff there to break down the starches.
Well, you know, a certain amount of sulfur is actually, you know, it's an essential nutrient. It's the core of several of the essential amino acids. But large amounts of sulfur can be really poisonous and or really, you know, not healthy for you.
There's a difference between the mineral sulfur and the chemical.
The organic forms of sulfur, yeah.
Yeah, the sulfuric acid, man, it gets in there, and it's just no wonder we're all dying with heartburn. And it eats the lining out of the inside of the cow's stomach, and they suffer from polio encephalitis, the horriblest death that an animal can possibly die from. And if you ever see animals dying from this, you'll never want to see another one die again. That's what's been happening on our farm and other farms. Other farms done said it's the horriblest death they've ever seen.
Wow.
The animal rights people needs to come alive on this because the government is dragging their feet on it. I've been raising hell with them now for 5 years.
Are you a cattle farmer, Dale?
Yes, dairy farmer.
Dairy farmer. Okay, so you're speaking from personal experience here.
Yeah, I'm speaking from personal experience, and I've been raising hell with them for the last 5 years, and they're working slow because this is big business for the government. The government's sanctioned it, and they've got the rates set so high that there's no way that if you get hit with two of those things at the same time, there's no way that a...
The rates meaning the level, the acceptable levels of sulfuric acid residue and mycotoxin.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Dale, thanks for the heads up on this. You know, cows are ruminants. They don't have high acidic levels in their stomachs like we do. We're more omnivores, and we have a fairly low pH, high acid level in our stomach. And so it would make sense that something really acidic would rip up a cow's stomach. Thank you, Dale. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And this, I just love this article. Kurt Eichenwald, Kurt Eichenwald and James Risen, who was a guest here in studio, last week, I think it was? Or earlier, was it earlier this week? Last week, yeah, I can't keep track of time. I'm hopeless. But anyhow, these two guys wrote some brilliant stuff outing the Bush administration back in the early 2000s on their lies about the war in Iraq and their lies about WMD and their lies about, you know, who was being injured and who wasn't in Iraq and things like that. And now Kurt Eichenwald has a piece in the current issue of Vanity Fair, the November 6th issue of Vanity Fair, and it's titled 30 Years of Conservative Nonsense, An Explainer, right? Where he takes these conservative stories. For example, tax cuts pay for themselves. He says the fantasy, as of in 1981, as he championed massive tax cuts, Ronald Reagan promised there would be no growth in the federal budget deficit because of the economic boom from tax cuts. Reality, deficits rose 2.6% of GDP by 1983, the highest in peacetime history. And Reagan admitted failure in 1982, a year later, started raising taxes. And, you know, it goes on. So here's another one. Deregulating the thrift industry will save it, right? That, again, this is something Reagan tried. And, in fact, he signed this law to deregulate the thrift industry in 1982. He says, I think we hit the jackpot. He called it the Emancipation Proclamation for America's Savings Institutions. What happened to the thrift industry? Went into the tank. Here's another, the fantasy. Iraq won the tilt. Here's another one, giving Iranian moderates weapons will help America, another conservative fantasy. Raising taxes will cause a recession, another Republican conservative fantasy. Abolishing bank regulations will help the economy, another fantasy. And here he's quoting Byron Dorgan. I mean, this is Byron Dorgan, Tom Harkin, Barbara Boxer, Russ Feingold, and others. This is 1999 when they repealed Glass-Steagall with Gramm-Leach-Bliley. Whoa. Dorgan was wrong. He says it didn't take 10 years for the repeal to bear poison fruit. It took 9. It was the economic collapse of 2008. Bin Laden was a front for Iraq, right? Yeah, no, it wasn't. WMDs, inexpensive war. Obamacare, the fantasy that the government was taking over health care. Nobody's going to sign up for it. It's going to fail. He takes that advice. So Kurt Eichenwald, just doing a brilliant job over at Vanity Fair of deconstructing Reaganomics and right-wing fantasies. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. You need to check it out. We got a lot of new jobs, other 200,000-plus job month. We will be talking to the Secretary of Labor at the bottom of the hour about that. Right now, it's Anything Goes Friday. Bob in Trabuco County, Canyon, California. Am I saying that right, Bob?
Trabuco.
Okay, great. What's up?
Yeah. I have a concern. Right now, 30 states, the Republicans have control of both state houses.
Mm-hmm.
And it only takes 33 or 34 states to call a constitutional convention and 37 to ratify. Don't you think they could be possibly playing really long ball here in the next couple of elections to...
That's a very sobering thought. That's a very sobering thought. But what would they want to amend the Constitution to do?
Stop abortions, gay marriage.
Yeah, I don't think that the Republican Party, they give lip service to those things, but there's a reason why they haven't stopped abortion since 1973 when Roe v. Wade was passed. Well, it's a huge money generator, and as long as the issue is out there, they can campaign on it. So they're never going to give the anti-abortion people what they want. And, you know, and the big thing, though, is when you look at the Republican Party, the things that they do around the edges are designed to bring in voters, and the posturing is designed to bring in voters. But the real purpose of the Republican Party is to make life easier for billionaires and big corporations. So if they were to amend the Constitution, I think it would probably be to do essentially to say that Citizens United is now part of the Constitution or something like that. You know, something to solidify oligarchy in the United States.
You don't think they're that craven?
Oh, I think they're very craven. That's my point. I think they're more craven than you are. I think if they're going to amend the Constitution, they're going to do it to make themselves rich. They're not going to do it to satisfy, a few people who might vote for them. That's a very sobering perspective, Bob. Thanks for calling and sharing it with us. Let me chew on that for a day or three and get back with you. I appreciate the call. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, you have a theory about why Democrats lost?
Yeah, failed to pay heed to what Ann Richards said 30 years ago, that the electorate, given the choice between Republican light and a real Republican, will take the real thing every time.
Right. Republican light and the guys of Democrat. Harry Truman said that back in the 40s, too.
Yeah, and all the candidates were running around saying, I don't know Obama. I'm just like the Republican, just a little less icky.
Yeah.
You know? And by the way, been listening to you since you were fighting it out with, Larry King, late night radio on AM back in my teenage days.
Wow.
So, we go way back.
Well, thank you, Chris. Yeah, I've thank you very much.
Some years you were hard to keep up with, but.
Yeah, well, a lot of years I was off the air, but
jumping around the dial and off the air. And,
yep. But we've been on for the last 10 years, and it's been a great ride, and we're still having a good time. I think your point, though, you know, you said why the Democrats lost. I think it's really important to remember that the new senator from Michigan, what's his name? It starts with a P. I want to say Price. That's not it. But the new senator from Michigan actually asked Obama to come to Michigan and campaign with him. He won walking away. This is the guy who's replacing Carl Levinas, if my recollection is correct. And Al Franken, who embraced the president, won. Jeff Merkley in Oregon, who embraced the president and progressive policies, won. All the Democrats who lost were Democrats who had turned their back on the president and who had turned their back on progressive policies. And Chris, thank you for the call. I sure hope that the leadership of the Democratic Party and those Democrats who are up for election 2 years from now get that message.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The new senator from Michigan is Gary Peters, and he actually had Obama come to Michigan, campaigned with him, and he won! Twenty-eight minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Secretary Tom Perez is on the line with us, the United States Secretary of Labor. With the U.S. Department of Labor, DOL.gov is their website. Secretary Perez, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. You've got some great job numbers, it looks like.
This was another solid report, Tom. We now have been 9 straight months over 200,000 jobs. That hasn't happened since the mid-90s. A year ago, our unemployment rate was 7.2%. Now it's 5.8%. Went down last month, as it has previously, for good reasons, because people are getting jobs, and they're getting jobs in a variety of sectors, including construction and manufacturing, retail, business and professional services, which are very well-paying jobs like architects, engineers, consultants, things of that nature. So we're moving in the right direction. We've undeniably got a lot more work to do, and one of the biggest challenges is to ensure that there's shared prosperity. Because in my travels, I talk to too many people who've been working hard, but they haven't gotten a raise in years. They've been helping to bake the cake of prosperity, but they're not really sharing in the prosperity, and that's not fair. And their sweat equity isn't translating into financial equity, and that's why we see angst across this country. And I understand that, and the president understands that, and that's why we're continuing to be hard at work to pick up the pace of growth.
That's great, I get it. It's been, I think, about 5 years since Nancy Pelosi was running the House of Representatives, and she got passed out of the House a piece of legislation that would have removed the tax incentives for doing things like Mitt Romney's Bain Capital did just, 2 years ago with this company, Sensata, in Ohio, where they took the company, the factory apart brick by brick, shipped it to China, reassembled it there. We had some of the workers on the program here talking about it, you know, just how devastating it was. There was actually a tax benefit to this company to do that. This legislation would have done away with that, and it would have reversed the incentive so that if they were to bring the factory back to the United States, it would have helped, or they would have then gotten a tax advantage. It went to the Senate. The Republicans filibustered it. It died. I don't know of any consequential legislation in the last 4 or 5 years that would do as that piece of legislation would have done, would have increased employment in a really measurable way. So is this uptick in jobs, A, have I missed something, or B, is this uptick in jobs just the logical and predictable consequence of pent-up demand over a long period of time?
Well, I think the uptick we see in jobs is a function of a lot of resilience of American workers, American businesses, and partnership with government. You know, I met a guy, Tom, in Western Massachusetts. He owns an advanced manufacturing company. In the height of the recession, he had this incredibly parallel universe existence. He was turning down business because he couldn't, he couldn't find workers with the right skill set to do the jobs.
Right.
And so what we did at the Department of Labor, I often refer to us as match.com. You know, we match workers who want to punch their ticket to the middle class with employers who want to grow their business. We helped establish an advanced manufacturing partnership out in Western Massachusetts with our training funds. And now he has grown his business. These are folks making $20-$25 an hour. And that's how we help grow the economy. Then, so you look at manufacturing numbers. Manufacturers want to bring their work back to Washington. Insourcing is the term, and outsourcing is the out term.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is good news. So all across this country, I see manufacturers and other businesses who are bullish about the future. And what we're trying to do here with the federal government and our state and local partners is to make sure that we can match them with the workers who are out there hardworking, sometimes in need of a little bit of upskilling, and that's what we do. So these reports are the function of a very deliberate and concerted effort and partnership between government and business to grow our middle class and move our nation forward.
That's great. It's great to hear from a secretary, in your case, Secretary of Labor, who believes the government can work, can do things. I mean, it's...
Well, Tom, I go across this country and I meet people. You know, there's a woman named Catherine Hackett whom I know well. She's out. She lives in Connecticut. Catherine is a single mother of two adult children, both of whom are serving with distinction in the armed forces, including one of her sons in Afghanistan. She had a white-collar job in Connecticut a couple of years ago. She was let go without any warning, and she was one of those long-term unemployed people with immense talent who were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. She actually introduced the president one day at an event where we were talking about how to help the long-term unemployed. And I met with her literally a couple weeks ago in a trip I had to Connecticut. She's back at work. She's punched her ticket again to the middle class. She has that dignity back. And we helped her get that job through our American Job Centers. And there's 2,500. They're in your communities. They're in every community across this country. We played Match.com for Catherine, and I talked to her boss. They love her. She's got great talent. And that's what we're doing in communities across this country. I do believe that our services can be a force for good and help people to get back on their feet and enjoy the dignity of work.
So for somebody who's listening right now and is unemployed and looking for work, how do they – I know Match.com isn't your website. How do they find
– there, that will be a different conversation.
Right, right.
They're not married if they do that.
Yeah. So how do they find – you know, how do they find your offices? How do they find your website? What should they do?
Yeah, DOL.gov. They get on there. They can search, and there's an American Job Center in their backyard, and we can get information for you on the closest one to you. If you don't have access to the internet, you can use our call center, which is 1-866-487-2365. Mm-hmm. 1-866-487-2365. And there's so many tools available on our website. So if folks have access to a computer and to the internet, there's a lot of people are trying to figure out, well, what is my next move? What do I want to do next?
Yeah.
I was doing one job before, and that job has gone away, and it may not come back. And so what is my next move? So we actually have a link called mynextmove.dol.gov, and it's a very user-friendly, interactive website that it asks you a few questions, you type it in, whatever the answers are, and up pop opportunities, either opportunities for jobs that exist now or opportunities for training that will enable you to get that job that is consistent with what your goals are.
Am I correct in assuming that these sorts of programs have been deleted from Paul Ryan's budget? And if so, how are you going to deal with the Republican Congress?
Well, we're going to continue to work collaboratively as best we can. The amount of funding for these investments has undeniably diminished. But at the same time, we have found ways to work in a bipartisan fashion, and we're going to continue to do so. One of the few pieces of consequential legislation that passed in the last Congress was actually the reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act. These are all the various training programs that we fund and support and encourage. And I have been in this line of work at a local government level, at a state level. I was the labor secretary in Maryland and now here. And what I've always tried to do is to take this issue outside the realm of partisan politics And the most recent reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act was overwhelmingly bipartisan. And that's because people who lost their jobs were in blue states and red states. The work we do to help people upskill helps everyone. And we're working hard to educate folks in Congress that this is an incredible service. We're trying to grow the number of apprentices in this country. There are so many employers that want to replace an aging workforce or grow an existing workforce or both. And so in the skilled trades, there are opportunities in industries like IT and cybersecurity and healthcare. There are opportunities for people to earn while they learn.
Yeah.
And these are things we're working on a bipartisan fashion. That's a word that is in short supply, and we're hoping to make sure that we continue to do this, because this is about growing the middle class.
Yeah, I'm assuming
that's what we're up to.
I'm assuming when you say replace an aging workforce, you're talking not about, you know, getting rid of 50-year-olds, but rather people who are aging out of the workforce.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People
okay.
who are retiring.
Yeah.
I was out in Boeing at one of their manufacturing facilities outside of Seattle about 2-3 months ago, and a third of their workforce is within 5 to 7 years of retirement.
Wow.
So I'm glad you asked that clarifying question, because what I was saying was as the population ages and gets near retirement, we've got to have a succession plan.
Yeah.
I look at that issue here at the Department of Labor. We have roughly 16, 17,000 employees, and there's a substantial percentage that could walk out the door tomorrow.
Right.
And so we have to be thinking about succession planning, and that presents opportunities for young people and others in this economy to punch their ticket to the middle class.
There you go. Well, you've got a big job ahead of you. Labor Secretary Tom Perez, U.S. Secretary of Labor, trying to deal with and doing actually a great job of dealing with the consequences of 34 years of Reaganomics. I salute you, sir. Thanks for dropping by today.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Great talking with you. I do appreciate you dropping by. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back to Anything Goes Friday, right after this. Welcome back. Kenneth in Perrington, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Welcome, Kenneth. What's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
What I'm thinking here is that election should be a heads-up for for Democrats. I mean, it should really teach us something.
Yep.
And I'm also thinking that this could actually be a blessing in disguise, because now the Republicans either got to put up or shut up. They've got the power. They can make some things happen. Or they can just stand around and complain.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that, you know, as much as I was unhappy that the Democrats lost so many seats, that on the other hand, all of the seats that were lost by conservadems, people who had run away from the president, people who had run away from traditional Democratic policies. And the people who easily won, as I pointed out, Gary Peters in Michigan invited President Obama to Michigan to campaign for him. Al Franken embraced the president. Jeff Merkley embraced the president and his policies, not necessarily all of his policies, but all the progressive policies. And I think that if there is a big message out of this election, when you look at the ballot measures all over the country, and you know, which is a huge list. I mean, you're raising the minimum wage, decriminalizing pot, rejecting the anti-abortion things, fracking bans in 3 different states, paid sick time in 4 states, reducing felonies in California, gun control in the state of Washington, bail reform in New Jersey, a GMO ban or a moratorium in Hawaii, a move to amend had ballot things going all over the country, and they won all of them. The Seattle taxed themselves to pay for preschool. California, Berkeley, California, you know, passed a soda tax. San Francisco raised their minimum wage to $15. What all this says is that America is a center-left country. America is a progressive country. And when Democrats try to run on being center-right, they lose. especially if they're running against Republicans who are right. And this goes back to what Harry Truman said. You know, nobody wants a phony politician. And if they're presented with a Democrat who's behaving like a Republican versus a Republican who is a Republican, they'll pick the Republican. Of course, you know, you want the real deal. You want somebody who you can trust that, you know, what they say is what they believe in. So, yeah, I think you're right. And I think that this is, and the president framed this perfectly yesterday or the day before when he had, I think it was Wednesday, when he had his post-drubbing press conference. And he basically said, now we're going to see what the Republicans have to offer. And they kept asking him, well, Mr. President, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And he said, well, let's see what the Republicans come up with. In other words, he's throwing the pressure onto them. And
absolutely. They need that. They have not governed in a long time, and I don't know if they're actually capable of it.
They're not. I mean, and when they do govern, all they do is screw things up. Look at Bush. You know, I mean, it's
okay.
It was just a screaming, flaming disaster. And you know, Republican governance is an oxymoron.
Yep.
And so, Kenneth, thanks a lot for the call. I think the tragedy of our corporate media is that, to the best of my knowledge, nobody in the corporate media is saying, at least the possible exception of some of the folks on MSNBC, but by and large, in the large mainstream corporate media, nobody's saying what I just said, which is that, you know, being a conservative is not going to win you elections. Being progressive will. It did. The progressives, Jeff Merkley, Gary Peters, Al Franken, they all won big. The conservatives, they got thrown out of office. And all of the progressive ballot measures all over the country, even in really, really red states like Arkansas and Nebraska, progressive measures won. Hey, Democrats, wake up. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. This Veterans Day week, the American Nurses Foundation wants every American to know more about treating post-traumatic stress for you and someone you care about. You can visit nurseptsdtoolkit.org to learn more. That's nurseptsdtoolkit.org. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, me too. So what's going on in the world?
Well, let me start overseas, in the United Kingdom, in fact, where I was on the Daily Telegraph website reading a very serious story about armed police arresting four men amid fears of an Islamist Remembrance Day terror plot. And my eyes wandered down to the, you know, there's always a section on websites, news most viewed.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, well, what's on the Daily Telegraph, which is one of the big four serious newspapers in the country.
In the United Kingdom.
In the United Kingdom, one of the big four serious newspapers, which leans right. Thought, oh, what are the news most viewed top five stories? At number four, cannibal murderer lured victim Seris Yem to hotel.
Right.
At number three, gardener died after brushing past poisonous plant in millionaire's garden.
Right.
And at number one, suspected murderer tasers as he ate body parts.
I'm getting a theme here.
That's what they're reading, apparently.
Yes, yes. If it bleeds, it leads.
Apparently, this is what your serious conservative, your Tories in the financial district in the City of London are reading today.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting, if you go over to Daily Caller or, you know, many of the Tucker Carlson's, maybe that's media, some of the others, you see an awful lot of scantily clad women. I mean, really large numbers of them.
Oh, yes, you do.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, what conservatives like to read about is cannibalism, and what they like to look at are scantily clad women.
Well, I like to read about cannibalism, too.
Yeah, I suppose we all have a little...
I think we all do.
We all have a little voyeurism, don't we?
We do.
Or a little curiosity or whatever, yeah.
Moving back over here,
mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court today agreed to hear a new challenge to the Affordable Care Act, imperiling President Obama's signature legislative achievement, which it underwent another challenge a couple of years ago. The case is King versus Burwell, and it concerns tax subsidies that are central to the operation of the law. Now, according to the challengers, the subsidies are not available in the states that have decided not to run the marketplaces.
Right.
And under the law, the government, the federal government, has stepped in to run exchanges. Now, if the challengers are right, millions of people getting the subsidies would become ineligible for them, which would basically destabilize and maybe doom the entire law.
Right. And this is the kind of thing, I mean, after Medicaid was after Medicare was passed in 65, 66, whatever the year was, there were hundreds of amendments to tweak it and make it work better. You know, when Social Security was passed in 1935, it's been amended probably 1,000 times or more to fine tune it. And this is the kind of thing that with a very simple one sentence amendment could change the legislation so that rather than saying in states that have exchanges, it could say in states that use their own exchanges or use the federal exchange. I mean, it was just a couple of words and it would solve the problem. But the Republicans refuse to allow any fine-tuning of Obamacare that doesn't involve destroying Obamacare to be considered in the House or in the Senate.
Right, and this is a serious challenge. So
yeah.
we'll see what happens to that.
Yeah.
Meantime, Loretta Lynch, the top federal prosecutor in Brooklyn, has emerged as a leading contender to be the next attorney general, officials close to the process are saying, as President Obama is looking outside his inner circle to fill this post. One of the reasons he's looking outside his inner circle is that people inside his inner circle are basically unconfirmable.
Huh.
If he does the confirmation after the lame duck session.
Unconfirmable because the Republicans consider them too liberal?
Too liberal, too tainted. People like Tom Perez, for example, would be considered a provocation because from the Labor Department. He already faced tough Republican opposition to his confirmation last year. Donald Verrilli, Solicitor General, he's got ties to Obama and the administration. He defended the Affordable Care Act before the Supreme Court. That would be tough. I think
that's
he'd be
horrible.
An awful choice, actually.
Yeah.
So people like that, and also there's a feeling among many people, Democrats also, that it's time for Obama to stop being so insular.
Yeah.
So she's a black woman. She would be the first black woman attorney general.
She's the one who's prosecuting Michael Grimm, the Republican congressman who's being charged with fraud out of New York City, who just got reelected.
Right.
Is that going to be a problem for her?
There was
another high-profile prosecution she was in charge of some Republican. I forget which it was.
I'm not sure. But she's done quite a lot of interesting. She's done many terrorism cases also.
Mm. Yeah.
She also supervised the successful prosecution of a white New York police officer who, remember, sodomized a Haitian.
Oh, that was the one I was thinking of. Yeah, he wasn't a Republican. He was just a cop.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, she did that one, too. So, but that has not been announced yet, and I was at Josh Earnest's briefing, and he would not confirm that.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting.
That was interesting. The Senate Judiciary Committee is going to vote on a bill to update the Freedom of Information Act as one of its first items next week, November the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bill introduced by Pat Leahy and also Senator John Cornyn, and it would require federal agencies to adopt a preemption of openness when considering whether to release documents under the law.
In other words, your default mode is openness rather than paranoia.
Yes.
Huh.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
Also, U.S. payrolls grew modestly this month, but the unemployment rate fell and wages did edge up. Signs the labor market is still strengthening.
Yeah, we just had Tom Perez on the program. He was talking about that. Great stuff. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by NursePTSDToolkit.org. Victoria, thank you, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, you too.
Thank you very much. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your thoughts, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. It is Anything Goes Friday. And it's an interesting day. Every now and then, you know, there are some personal stories that you just don't share. But on the other hand, sometimes there are personal stories that are worth sharing because maybe somebody else could learn from it. Maybe and I've discovered a startling number of people who share this malady with me. When I was, and apropos of today, I woke up this morning and I went blind. I was trying to read something, and all of a sudden, everything I looked at, the letters just vanished right at the middle of my field of vision. And then these little sparkles that were obscuring the letters got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it turned into this semicircle with the giant zigzags going through it that was bright black and yellow of blindness, and moved out into my peripheral vision. I got my central vision back, but then I lost my peripheral vision. And the whole process lasts about an hour, and then I'm left with a headache and tinnitus, or however you say it, ringing in the ears, which I'm hearing right now. This was just maybe 5 hours ago, 6-7 hours ago. And I first experienced this when I was 7 years old. I had one of these, it knocked me down. I was in school, I was in second grade, and it just I literally knocked me out of my chair. It hurt so badly. It was, you know, I mean, this is a kind of a semi-classic migraine headache. And my parents took me to the doctor, and they did all these tests, and they couldn't figure out what it was, and it went away after a couple of weeks. But I was having them every day for a while, and then after a few weeks, they went away. And then maybe 20 years ago or so, I was teaching advertising and marketing seminars around the country, and I was in San Francisco. I was staying down at Fisherman's Wharf at the Hyatt down there, and on one side of the hotel is a Japanese restaurant, and the other side of the hotel is a Chinese restaurant, and I was eating at, but it was a three-day seminar workshop that I was teaching, so I was there for 4 or 5 days, and I was eating at these two restaurants every day. And the third day of the seminar, I'm in the middle of the seminar, I'm standing in front of a room of like 50, 60 people talking, and all of a sudden I lose my central vision. I'm going blind. And it was the first time it had happened really in a big way since I was 7 years old. And I had this vague memory of it from when I was seven, but it was like, whoa, what's this? And I thought, I'm having a stroke or I'm going blind. You know, something's going on here. Something really nasty's going on. But I just kept talking. I didn't want to say to everybody, oh my God, you know. And so I just kept talking, even though I couldn't see. And after about 10 minutes, it moved into my peripheral vision, and I could see my students again, and within an hour it was gone. And so that night, as soon as the class was done, around 5 o'clock, I took a cab down to Kaiser Permanente, the nearest hospital, and checked myself into their ER, and I said, you know, here's what's going on. And the doctor was an ethnically Asian guy. He was an American, but he was of Chinese ancestry. And he said, I described the symptoms to him, and he said, have you been eating Chinese food? And I said, yeah. And he said, you have Caucasian MSG disease. I was like, what? And he said, you wouldn't believe the number of white people who come into this ER describing the same symptoms you have. And it's because you're allergic to monosodium glutamate and other glutamates. There are, you know, these glutamates that occur in various foods. And so he said, just stop eating Chinese food, you'll be fine. And I did, and I was. So I was back in Michigan, I don't know, a month or two later. And this was back when my mom and dad were both still alive. And I was talking to my mom. I'm sitting in their living room, and I'm telling my mom about what happened. And she's like, oh, my God, now I know what happened when you were seven. And I was like, what's that? And she said, well, there was this article in Parade magazine that was asking, why is it that Asian students do so well academically, and was speculating that it was MSG, that it was some kind of brain food. And so I went out and I bought a thing of MSG at the Kroger store, and I sprinkled it into all the food I made for you for weeks. And then when I ran out of it, I forgot to get some more, and your headaches went away. And I never put two and two together, but that must have been it. So this happened to me this morning. It happened to me last night while I was doing my TV show. It happened in the middle of the TV show, the third block of the show, from 30 minutes after until 45 minutes after. I was basically blind. And it happened when I was talking to Sarah Van Gelder. It started out, I was having trouble reading the prompter, and then I turned to Sarah, and through that 5 or 6 minutes that I was interviewing her, I just lost all my central vision. By the time I was done, I had lost my peripheral vision, but my central vision was back, so I was able to go back and finish reading from the prompter, and I finished the show, and I never said anything about it to anybody other than Louise. But it had also happened last Friday, as I was going to the airport, Saturday morning on my way to Michigan, and it had happened the day before yesterday. And so this morning, when this happened, I said to Louise, I mean, this is weird. Can you help me figure out where I've been eating? Because I think I'm getting MSG. And she was like, you know, when we went through restaurants and meals, and I couldn't figure it out. And then she said, you know, 2 weeks ago, I bought a bottle of gluten-free soy sauce. And I've been using that instead of salt. And I've been putting it in chili. And Thursday morning, we had scrambled tofu, and it was full of that. And so we grabbed the bottle, and it was half empty. In a week and a half. And it, sure enough, it was made with hydrolyzed soy protein and, quote, natural flavors, which is how MSG appears on a lot of labels. So I threw that out this morning. And I share that with you because two of my kids have the same sensitivity. And this is, as I said, this is fairly common. So And it's what the doc in the ER room told me was it was startling to him how many people put up with this and had been for years on painkillers and even narcotics for migraine headaches and things when all they really needed to do was stop eating MSG. So just an FYI. Long personal story, probably longer than it deserved, but hey, what the heck? It's Anything Goes Friday. My turn to share. Douglas, but I can see right now just fine, and my headache is going away. Douglas in Sacramento, California. Hey, Douglas, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for the forum.
Yeah.
I don't think move to amend is going far enough. I think what they're doing is fine, but Citizens United is wrong whether money is considered speech or not.
You're right.
We regulate speech all the time where we need everybody to be heard.
Yep.
There's even a concept in communications theory, I think, called message space. There's only so much of it to go around. If I went to a city council meeting with a megaphone to shout everybody else out, they'd throw me out, and they'd be right to.
Right.
But that's the situation we have here with media communications today.
You're right. But here's what you might be missing, and correct me if I'm not speaking to your concern. What move to amend's amendment that would say corporations aren't people and money isn't speech anymore would do is absolutely nothing on day one, right? You pass that amendment, that constitutional amendment, nothing changes, except that now Congress can pass laws. They can go back to 1973, look at the legislation they passed to regulate money in politics after the Nixon crimes were revealed, and we could once again put that legislation into place. That legislation has been knocked down in a series of Supreme Court decisions. Buckley versus Vallejo in 1978, First National Bank versus Black, right up to 2010, Citizens United McCutcheon this year. So it would enable Congress to pass legislation to regulate money and speech, which I know from talking both to Republicans and Democrats, they want to do. There are so many members of Congress, outside of people like Daryl Issa, who are mind-bogglingly and independently wealthy, most members of Congress hate the fact that they have to spend 6 hours a day raising money. Make sense, Douglas?
Oh, I get that. I get that, Tom. But and I'm not saying they should do anything different, but I'm saying we should look to the future and
Oh, yeah. We need to be getting the legislation ready that we could pass if these constitutional amendments were put into place and lobbying for it. And frankly, that we might be able to pass if the nature of the Supreme Court changes and a new court overturns the old court. Douglas, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls and stories and tall tales and whatnot right after this. It's 15 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Don, watching Free Speech TV in Long Beach, California on the Dish Network. Don, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure. My pleasure.
Tom, I think the world of you.
Thank you.
And before I begin my diatribe concerning President Obama, I'd like to state that history will prove this man to be a very good president, standing head and shoulder with some of the other presidents like Roosevelt and Truman and other great men.
I think he's going to be remembered as one of our great presidents.
Yes, I believe that. But, Tom, I believe that the loss of the House and the Senate was due solely to Obama's administration through his practice of delegating what his subordinates are supposed to do. They're supposed to be passing out literature and everything concerning all the good things that this man has done that the nation knows nothing of.
Right.
Because his subordinates do not get the word out. And I believe that he do not have the ability to confront white people. And I believe this is because he was raised by a white family. Tom, we know that even during slavery, construction, at the abolition period, blacks stood up because they were confrontational. Obama lacks this. He lacks the, they disrespect him in the House. They disrespect him in the Senate. They disrespect him in the public. They disrespect him in his own house. And yet he cannot stand up. And I believe this is because he was raised by a white family and do not have that black confrontational spirit. And I'll end it by saying I'm beginning to agree with the black professor out of Princeton by the name of West. I know you're very
Cornell West, yeah.
Of him, that Obama do not have the wherewithal to delegate. And with that, Tom,
yeah.
I love you very much.
Don,
you're the only person that I listen to on television except for a movie.
Well, thank you, Don. Don, are you African-American?
Yes, I am.
So your family has presumably a lineage that goes back to the days of slavery. Do you think that it might be that because Obama is not part of a lineage that goes back to slavery, he acquired his African-American-ness by virtue of his father literally being an African who came to the United States, that change? I mean, I didn't grow up African-American. I don't consider myself qualified to speculate on this or psychoanalyze him or culturally analyze him. But you have far more of the right to than I do. Your thoughts on that possibly as the variable rather than that he was raised by a white family, because it appears
okay,
that the white family that raised him was very supportive.
I believe the two are equal to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That because he was raised by the white family, he was not brought up in that era of confrontation,
mm-hmm.
that he do not know how to interact and actually feel intimidated by whites, having a white mother, a white father, a white grandmother, and so forth and so on. I believe he do not have that ability, but the man to me is almost perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And history will prove it. I know they will.
Yeah.
But I believe that because he cannot delegate to his administration, even the vice president gets up there and jokes and so forth instead of telling the public what his president has done. And I believe
yeah.
this is because the president do not get this out to them.
Yeah, I agree that his surrogates have done a very bad job of proclaiming his successes. Don, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. 20 minutes past the hour. 20 minutes past the hour, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. My body slowly cleansing itself of the MSG. My eyes working again. Oh, man. I probably should have told that story on the radio, because now anybody who wants to, like, sabotage me, you know, let's have lunch, Tom, here, have this, you know, it's Tastes flavorful, doesn't it? Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just real quickly, as regards to that last caller, it depends on who writes the history, whether or not President Obama will get some recognition.
Yeah, I mean, Ronald Reagan was a horrible president. He had a terrible recession on his watch. He tripled the national debt. The more people were convicted of felonies who were members of his inner circle and senior officials in his administration than any administration in history. I mean, he was more corrupt than the Coolidge administration with Teapot Dome. And yet, because the Republicans put together this Reagan legacy project after Reagan left office to name a post office or other building after him. And I mean, here in D.C., it's the airport in every single congressional district in the United States and in every country in the world. And to rewrite the history books and rewrite Wikipedia and everything else, people think that he was some kind of great president. He was not. He was a pathetic president. He was a lousy president.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're
anyway,
right.
The reason I called was just to take a temperature of the racism, the white racism, I want to call it that, against the people of color is more overt than I have ever experienced in my 66 years on this planet.
Are you speaking as a white guy or as a person?
As a white guy.
Okay.
As a white guy. People, what I see, just this is all anecdotal. I would go to work. I just recently retired. And I can't tell you that if I had a buck for every time I hear the N-word referred to toward the guy who's in the White House, I would have been able to retire sooner.
Yeah.
Along with that, though, that's just anecdotal. People seem to feel free to express that. And racism has been repackaged by places like Fox News as, you know, anybody who even complains about some kind of discrimination is a racist themselves.
Right.
But the other thing that I read recently was Ben Stein just recently wrote an article saying that President Obama is the most racist president in America, even in light of the fact that at least a dozen presidents owned slaves. He decided to put this moniker on him, and saying that his folks are accusing Republicans of having policies that are anti-black or anti-brown or whatever.
Yeah.
But did you read that? Did you hear anything about that, Ben Stein?
No, I didn't. I try to avoid Ben Stein. He's so toxic. It used to be entertaining. Now it just makes me feel like dirty.
Well, I thought he was good with Rodney Dangerfield.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
It's just out there everywhere, Tom. It's so discouraging.
Yeah, I understand. And you're finding this in Delaware, what, among working class folks?
Yeah. I mean, people that are making 60 grand a year who are, technically educated.
Yeah.
And I work with a lot of people of many different races, colors, and ethnic backgrounds, and it's just amazing to me how easily this has been turned around.
Yeah,
and I think it has been turned around. Not every Republican is a racist, but racists are very comfortable being Republicans.
Yeah, yeah, well said, Andy. Thank you for the call, Alan in Pierpont, Ohio. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First of all, I would like to tell you that I consider you to be a living, I lost my train of thought there for a second, but in Japan,
that's okay, Alan.
National treasure.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you heard anything about this. I did not get the whole gist of the story, but in Illinois, they had passed some legislation. And they called it lockbox legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on a state level that if money is set aside for a specific project, that money is not to be used in any way, shape, or form outside of its designated use.
Right.
It's a shame that we can't do that on a federal level. We could probably save Social Security.
Yeah, well, Social Security doesn't even need saving. Social Security is just fine, thank you very much, and will continue to be for many years. We could, with some small tweaks around the edges, we could make Social Security even larger and more functional and stronger. But this was Al Gore's big thing in the 2000 election, which I thought was misguided, but nonetheless, or not misguided. I just thought that he should have been more of a populist. although he did win the election. What can you say? I get it. I don't know the nuance of the law in Illinois. At the federal level, typically legislation that appropriates money for particular purposes, it can only be used for those purposes. So there's not as much discretion as you may think. This is how, and sometimes legislation actually forbids the use of money for other purposes. This is how the Republicans have prevented President Obama from letting people out of Guantanamo. They've said, you know, you can't use any of the money for that. But interesting point, Alan. Thanks for the heads up on that. I'll have to check into it. Jack in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Jack. NLRB, National Labor Relations Board?
Yeah, well, first I want to just say a couple quick things. Thank you for all of your books that you've written, that you wrote. It's actually been a huge influence on my life and what I actually want to do.
Well, thank you.
Second, thank you for a retweet you did for me earlier or last week. It may have been someone on your staff, but I really appreciated that as well.
Sure. So to the issues, because we've only got 40 seconds left.
Yeah, the NLRB, the Democrats got shellacked in this election.
Well, the conservative Democrats got shellacked. The liberal Democrats won.
This is fair. But I'm concerned looking at the 2016 election, the appointments to the NLRB. Everyone always talks about the Supreme Court and the effect that's going to have on the American people. But the NLRB has a greater impact on the working people in this country, and it can have that effect much more quickly.
Right.
You look back and you see appointments to the NLRB, how laws have effects on working people.
No, you're absolutely right. These are the folks who enforce your right to unionize, for example. And they have been trashed by the Republicans. Excellent point, Jack. Excellent point. Well said. And I agree with you. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls right after this. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain, although does not lead to stiff thinking. Promised. Mary in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's really a pleasure talking to you. I've called before, but this is the first time I'm actually getting to talk to you, so this is a real thrill for me.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to echo what you were saying earlier about Democrats running away from this president and running as conservatives. And just to add to that story, let me just give you an example of what went on here in Arizona. In Congressional District 2, the district I live in, there is a neck and neck, literally neck and neck fight going on between Ron Barber and Martha McSally. The difference in the voting is McSally is up by 363 votes.
Whoa.
And there's still approximately 16 or 17,000 ballots that need to be decided. So this race isn't going to get decided until next week, essentially.
One's a Democrat, the other's a Republican, presumably.
Correct. Ron Barber is a Democrat. Martha McSally is a Republican.
Okay.
Now, if you look at Ron Barber's voting record, he's a solid liberal Democrat. However, that being said, if you look at the campaign ads he ran during the election, he basically talked about securing the border and veterans affairs. Those were the two main, the crux of his advertisements. And the other one was that he is bipartisan.
Right.
A lot of people stayed home. A lot of Democrats stayed home because they're really upset with him with some of these quote-unquote bipartisan votes that he did in Congress with relation to the government shutdown.
Yeah.
And in relation to voting on some aspects of Paul Ryan's budget.
It's incredible. You know, the Republicans know that they have to turn out their base and they pander to their base. They campaign to their base. And the Democrats, instead of campaigning to their base, they get these stupid advisors, these Democratic advisors who come in and say, well, you know, there's a lot of independents out there. There's more independents than there are registered Democrats. You need to reach out to the independents. And the independents are a little worried about gun control. And the independents don't, you know, they kind of like tax cuts for billionaires. And it's nuts, Mary.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, and Ron Barber's district covers two-thirds of Tucson, which is a liberal bastion here
sure.
in Arizona. But if you look at the solid progressive wins in Arizona, particularly rural Grijalva, whose district only covers a third of Tucson and all of Yuma, which is not known as a hotbed of liberal politics,
right.
He won overwhelmingly.
Right, because you know exactly where he stands.
Exactly. And also we have a lovely, I'm not in his district, a very wonderful, outspoken, progressive Democrat named Ruben Gallegos, who is now, will be a freshman congressman. He overwhelmingly won in his district. And Kirsten Sinema overwhelmingly won in her district, which encompasses Mesa and Scottsdale, which are not...
Scottsdale's very conservative. That's a very... I mean, that's old Goldwater country. It's very conservative.
Exactly.
Town. Upscale
exactly.
White
but
town.
That's right, but and very, very affluent.
Yeah.
But they ran as open, solid, progressive Democrats, and they overwhelmingly won their districts.
Yeah.
So I think there really is a lesson to be learned here that, you know, you've got to stand for something and not be straddling the fence.
Yeah, because voters know the old cliche is true. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And they want their politicians to have the courage of their convictions. And if you are a progressive Democrat, you should run as one, and the progressive Democrats will come out and support you. And if you're not a progressive Democrat, good luck. You're going to go the way of Mary Landrieu. Mary, thank you very much for the call. It's a very, very brilliant articulation of what's going on. Janice in Brandon, Vermont. Hey, Janice.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm calling about John Boehner, and I'd like to give you a hypothetical situation.
Sure.
Say I was running a company that only had about 50 employees, but they were making very serious decisions that would affect millions and millions of people.
Right.
And so there's random drug testing. Somebody comes up positive, they're fired.
Right.
Well, John Boehner, and he admits to going to the bar every night after work.
Yeah, John Boehner. I mean, read Bob Ney's autobiography, Sideswiped. John, he has a long descriptions of John. John Boehner's a high-functioning alcoholic.
Yes, right. But they can only be high-functioning for so long.
Hmm.
And my thing is, in a random drug test, would he pass?
No.
Alcohol's a drug.
No, because Boehner starts drinking in the middle of the day.
Yeah, and he drinks all night. So that's still in his system. Some people go to parties, and they've drank so much that the next morning they're headed to work and they get a DWI or DUI.
Right.
So why are we paying him to make serious decisions? Why is he still in?
Because the press will not talk about things like the drug problems of legislators, particularly powerful legislators, because those people, John Boehner has the power to basically destroy any of the media outlets or the careers of the people whose shows, you know, would choose to do this. If Meet the Press was to talk about John Boehner's alcoholism, you would not see a Republican show up on Meet the Press for months. And the result of that would be that Chuck Todd would be out of a job.
Yeah. Yeah. And he should be.
Yeah.
He just should be.
Well, you know, he should be for not bringing up Boehner's alcoholism. And yeah. Janice, excellent point. Thank you for the call and thanks for pointing it out. Channing in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Channing, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
I mean, I think that, President Obama, I think he's been a pretty good president in terms of policy, but I think that his political decisions have been, you know, I think that he's been, too soft. You know, I mean, it started with that red state, blue state speech that he's famous for, like in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can rise above partisan politics all you want, but they're not going to. And they never have and never will, you know. And
right.
I think that from the beginning, you know, he says, well, we're not going to relitigate the past, even though the Republicans sort of destroyed the country between 2002.
Yeah.
2006, right?
Yep.
And so what instead of like a bunch of Senate subcommittee hearings, you know, where we talk about how they ran up a bunch of deficit spending, you know, there's nothing there. They can just obstruct with a spending.
You know, part of me, I've said this a number of times over the years, part of me wishes that the president had never read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, what is it, League of Rivals or Band of Brothers or what, the book about how Lincoln's cabinet, you know, how Lincoln had brought his enemies into his cabinet, and his vice president was of the opposite party from him, and he was, you know, trying, team of rivals. Thank you, Shano. And he was trying to be transpartisan. He was trying to heal and bring the nation together. And clearly that imprinted on President Obama, and he's tried to do that. Now, that said, you know, and for these last 6 years, I've wanted him to be a partisan ass kicker, basically. But that said, I suspect that he's doing Aikido right now with the Republicans. You know, Aikido is the martial art where you take the energy of the person coming at you and you use it against them to basically, you know, flip them over your shoulder kind of thing. And,
I mean,
I think he's...
I think they've been able to define him. And I think he's allowed them to define him.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
not...
I don't disagree, but...
I think that, like, independent voters, I think that they look at this president as a big spending liberal president. And why they do that is because they can't, like, disseminate between the money that was spent during the Bush administration and the money that was had to be...
Well, they do that, Channing, because the Republican... many cases just out lies, right? You know, just flat out lies. And in other cases, distortions or just talking points, even sometimes correct ones, are pretty much the only talking points that get widely propagated in the American media. The Democratic talk. I mean, when was the last time you heard that the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives, the largest caucus in Congress, presented a budget that was a balanced budget that defended the interests of labor and average people and that strengthened Social Security? Nobody ever even talks about it. We hear about Paul Ryan's budget all the time, but not Jan Schakowsky's. And Jan Schakowsky's was actually a serious, credible budget that, you know, had the line item, everything that they're going to do, whereas Paul Ryan's was full of smoke and mirrors. So,
I think that if you just have to build leverage.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, like, if you would have had Senate subcommittee hearings that come out and talk about, you know, why is it that we put $2 trillion into a supplemental and we basically hid that from the American people? That's not just George W. Bush. That's the entire Republican leadership that did that. You know what I mean? That's Paul Ryan that did that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But if you just say, well, that's all water under the bridge, you just cede all that leverage.
Yeah, this is the biggest mistake. This was the biggest mistake of the Ford administration was pardoning Richard Nixon. And then every president since then, this was the biggest mistake, I think, of the early Clinton administration, was ignoring the crimes of the Reagan administration, the Reagan and Bush administrations, particularly with regard to Iran. And, you know, Bill Clinton said, oh, we're going to let bygones be bygones. And the result was that the crooks all walked, and George Bush Sr. had issued, you know, blanket pardons for all these people who had been convicted during the Reagan years. I'm with you, Cheney. Thank you very much for the call. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls, my comments, and the news of the day right after this. Like a needle? Oh, medieval. Yeah, interesting. Welcome back. We were just speculating about what the Capitol building looks like. My first thought was it looks sort of like it's got a condom on it, but not really. And Shane said it looks medieval. Yeah, it's very angular, and, you know, with all that scaffolding and then, you know, the goddess popping her head out of the top of it. Anyhow, Pam watching Free Speech TV in Falls Church, Virginia on Dish Network. Hey, Pam, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention that in this recent election rout, there's been more discussion, at least online, amongst Democrats about the 50-state strategy that Howard Dean had conceived, and I was glad to see him in the media a lot recently. I know he's active with his brother Jim, but I just wonder if on a national level people might start considering and looking towards him. And also another figure for me that pops out is possibly Alan Grayson, who I'm very appreciative that he retained his seat in Florida.
Yeah.
Don't know if they're interested at all, but there's a lot of, you know, a lot of commentary going around. And then I wanted to add, too, I'm so sorry that you experienced your vision problems, but I'm glad you brought that up because I had something very similar like that, but mine was not attributed to a food ingredient that I could eliminate. It was during a stressful work dysfunctional situation. I had it. It was pretty scary.
Yikes.
Not so much my central vision, but kind of a zigzag.
Yeah, the zigzags. That's the migraine thing. And I've gotten just in the last, just since I told the story on the air, I checked email. I had a bunch of emails from people telling me similar stories. One guy said red wine flipped it on for him. Another person said chocolate did it to them. I mean, apparently, this is how some food allergies manifest.
Well, and I never knew that. And mine was it's only happened like chronic stress, kind of anxiety situations. And then I was talking to a friend in a restaurant, and her sister said to me, the first time she said, oh, that's an eye migraine. I was like, really?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have headaches with mine, thank goodness, but it was unsettling. I had to do presentations. And I'm thinking about why. I had a very good ophthalmologist. I know a lot about vision. Mm-hmm. I never brought it up to him. And anyway, when you said the flashing lights and stuff, you know as well that sometimes that can be the vitreous gel of the eye.
Although it's not. Ellen Ratner lost one of her retinas. She has a detached retina, and so she's blind in one eye now. And this just happened 3 or 4 years ago. And she talks about this. So, I'm not talking out of school here. She's running around warning people about it. She got dehydrated, and I think it was on a travel back from Africa. And so she said, if you ever see sparkles in your eyes, look out, because that's the sign that your retina is loose. But that's not exactly what I was seeing. I was only seeing those right in the center of my vision, right in the fovea, the foveal part of the macula, or the macular part of the fovea. No, yeah, it's the foveal part of the macula, the little center part there that sees color.
It's interesting that people have responded because I was relieved to know what it was. Well, good luck with that in eliminating the MSG.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Pam. And you may even want to go, look back to that time when you experienced it and you were so stressed out. It could be the collision of stress and a food allergy. Or it might just be that, stress is what you're allergic to. It's whacking you. Pam, thank you for the call. And we'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our board op, Troy Miller, to writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at our various companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, from Comcast to Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you sincerely. Richard in Evanston, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi. I was wondering. I haven't followed the news. I one of the most chilling things I think I've experienced was yesterday when Boehner threatened the president, saying, if you do this, I've never experienced it except when Clinton was elected and they went after all of his donors and brought him before the Republican House when they said the Chinese had funded his, his first win.
Right.
And that went by without anybody commenting. But yesterday, that threatening of him, and it speaks to the racist aspect. Of course, he would never do that to, George Bush or a white man.
Right.
And he didn't, but he didn't respond back. And I'm wondering, isn't anybody disturbed by the tone of?
Well, I mentioned this in the first hour of the program, Richard. I said that don't play with matches because you'll burn yourself. Comment that John Boehner said to President Obama during this press conference is so condescending, so dripping with parentalism. You know, I'm the adult here. You're the child. That, you know, I mean, it's just, this is disrespect raised to the level of an art form. It's very, very insulting. And
well, I don't understand. I'm sorry. I was going to say, I don't understand why I didn't give him his list. You're not going to take away Affordable Care Act, et cetera. I mean, I don't understand. Yeah. If someone did that to me, they would have to call the police. I mean, this isn't Nazi Germany. This isn't these people so filled with hubris that they're going to tell everybody what to do and shut everybody up and take their vote away.
Yeah.
And there's just, I mean, the country accepts this.
Well, President Obama has his own style, and we all have to respect that. He's who he is. That said, I think I'm guessing probably every person of color, or a large percentage of the people of color in this country, heard that comment and knew exactly what it was. And I mean, I'm a white guy, and I heard that comment. You are too, I'm assuming, Richard. And
And you're right about him. His style is laudable. He's a gentleman, and I think a person is really trying to make things work. But and the people that blocked him and caused this disruption of our government, and they're handed back the reins of power by the people. I mean, this I just don't understand.
Well, it was political strategy. I mean, this was the political strategy that Frank Luntz hatched with these guys at the Caucus Room restaurant on January 20th, 2009. And then yesterday, Frank Luntz wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, recycling a couple of Republican lies and basically saying, ha ha, ta-da, we did it. And, they did. And the Democrats bought it hook, line, and sinker, and the American people did too. And I think it's a tragedy. Richard, thank you for the call. I share your outrage at Speaker Boehner's comments. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to discuss this past Tuesday's election and what went wrong for Democrats and where we go from here. In terms of what went wrong...
Jerry, I think that we need to be very careful about our language. On Tuesday, right across the country... By and large, Democrats who ran as progressives won, and in many cases won hugely. Democrats who ran as Republicans, like Mark Pryor and Mary Landrieu, they lost.
Right. Well, that's kind of the point I was going to make, is that I think far too many of the Democrats, not all of them, but some of them, these Democrats are running as these Clinton-style so-called new Democrats who try to co-opt and adopt Republican ideas. We had one Democratic candidate who even refused to say that she voted for a Democratic president, President Obama.
Yeah, which is insane.
Right. And you often quote Harry Truman. It's my favorite quote of him that you often give, that if voters have a choice between a Republican and a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, then they'll choose the Republican. And I think we saw a lot of that happening. And instead, what these Democratic candidates, what all of them should have done is they should have taken a page from the political playbook of that seemingly progressive Democratic senator from the swing state of Ohio, Sherrod Brown. He's defeated many conservative Republicans running against him with a progressive economic message.
Yeah, he totally kicked ass 2 years ago when Sherrod Brown ran for re-election, and he did it running on a campaign of, we're going to do away with these crazy trade policies, we're going to strengthen organized labor, we're going to strengthen environmental protections, we're going to strengthen Social Security, we're going to stop the Republicans from taking a meat axe to Medicare, we want to stop the privatization of our schools. Sherrod Brown is one of the best and most progressive senators in the United States Senate. And people don't get it. It's like, this guy won. And if you are progressive and you campaign as a progressive and you legislate as a progressive, people will reelect you because they want the minimum wage raised. Otherwise, in Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota, they wouldn't have raised the damn thing.
Right, exactly. And I think in terms of where we go from here, we have to continue the fight because McConnell and Boehner have laid out their legislative agenda. And so I think instead of just going to sleep, we progressives, we have to fight against final Obama administration approval of the Keystone Pipeline. We have to fight against the approval of the TPP trade deal, against corporate tax reduction. And we have to fight against the chain CPI or raising the eligibility raising the age of eligibility.
Yeah, you've identified the four big issues where Obama may cave into the Republicans, and we need to be holding his feet to the fire and holding tight to progressive positions. Jerry, thank you for the call. And thank you all for being with us all this week. We will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. Take good care of yourself. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require us to show up. We've got to participate. Just voting isn't enough. Tag, you're it. I'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.